Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, one election-related and the other, thank God, not. We'll hear from the historian and policy analyst Andrew Bacevich about what a Biden foreign policy might look like, and then the sociologist Alison Spurgis will explore female desire. Andrew Bacevich is an interesting figure, a self-described Catholic conservative and West Point graduate who spent over 20 years in the Army. He's made a name for himself in recent years as a critic of U.S. foreign policy. He has a Ph.D. in history and has taught at West Point, Johns Hopkins, and Boston University. He is now president of a think tank, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, whose mission is to promote, in its own words, a new foreign policy centered on diplomatic engagement and military restraint. Bacevich has been on the show a couple of times before to talk about Trump's foreign policy. Here he is to meditate about what a Biden foreign policy might look like, and to take the measure of the changes in the world since the last time the White House was occupied by a Democrat. Andrew Bacevich. So it looks like Joe Biden is going to be our next president if Donald Trump finally folds his tent. What kind of foreign policy do you see him conducting? Is it back to the Obama era or something different or what? What do you see?
Well, we don't know yet who Biden will appoint as the senior members of his team, meaning National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. Lots of rumors in that regard. The rumors point to people who had fairly senior positions in the last two Democratic administrations. So all we can do is speculate, but yeah, I would speculate it's going to be a return to the broad themes of the Obama and Clinton years.
And what were those? I mean, the Clinton years were a long time ago now.
But,
the Obama years are getting there quickly enough, but yeah. I mean,
you know, it's funny when you say that. The Clinton years do seem like a long time ago.
They were busily sorting out the collapse of the Soviet Union and doing a rather botched job of it, but they were, that was their obsession at the time.
They were. And I think that the attitudes and assumptions that prevailed then continued to influence basic U.S. policy all the way through the Obama era. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the belief that the end of the Cold War was a decisive turning point in all of history. The belief that as a consequence of the end of the Cold War, the United States had become the sole superpower, that the future of the world order would be one that would, in many respects, be determined by the United States. The end of the Cold War also prompted this explosion of American exceptionalism. I think if you want to, you know, reduce it to two words, it's the famous phrase coined by Madeleine Albright during the Clinton era, that we are the indispensable nation. And the principal way that we were going to demonstrate that indispensability was by amassing and using military power. My narrative of the post-Cold War era is a narrative of military activism that began under Clinton, certainly accelerated under George W. Bush, and continued under Obama.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, that sense the indispensable nation were the sole superpower. George Bush inherited that and turned it up to 11 for sure. But, you know, there were some continuities there, weren't there?
Oh, I think that, you know, people write books, will write more books about how these presidents differed from one another. But I've always believed that the continuities between them, meaning between Herbert Walker Bush, Clinton, George W. Bush and Obama, that the particularly in the realm of national security policy, it's the continuities that really tell us a lot about what the United States was all about.
We hardly ever think about H.W. these days, except to wax nostalgic about his waspy pulley test. But what was it about his era that was passed along to the Clintons? Was there anything, any distinguishing marks?
The willingness to use force dates from H.W., totally forgotten. In the fall of the Berlin Wall is October of 1989. December of 1989, he invades Panama. Wow. And, of course, then the very next year, 1990, we've got the 1990 to 91, we've got the Persian Gulf War to evict Saddam Hussein. At the very end of his term, George Herbert Walker Bush dispatches U.S. troops to Somalia on what begins as a humanitarian intervention, but actually ends up becoming a very dirty war between ourselves and Somali militants. So military activism begins under the elder Bush and continues throughout this period of time. Really, one of the distinctive attributes of the Trump candidacy was he was the guy who denounced all that military activism. He said that these endless wars were not in the interest of the country. He promised, if elected, to end the endless wars. Well, he was elected. No, he did not end them. But to your initial question, my sense is that that to at least some degree, the spirit of the early post-Cold War period will return in the Biden administration. Now, but let me emphasize, that doesn't mean that they will have learned nothing from our military failures. My guess is that under Biden, we're not going to have any invasions that are undertaken for the sole purpose of bringing about regime change, as was the case under George W. Bush. It will be interesting to see if the emphasis on climate change, which is certainly a theme of Biden's candidacy, it'll be interesting to see if that, what effect that has on overall national security policy. And more, and I think the metric there is probably going to be the size of the Pentagon budget. Is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? You know, will there be a new set of priorities that lead us to curb our willingness to shovel money at the Pentagon? Or will we just keep on doing that?
Now, the climate angle for national security is interesting because, you know, the U.S. military is the world's largest emitter of carbon by far, I believe. So if we wanted to do something about carbon emissions, choking back the military would be a good start. But then there's also all these anxieties about climate change leading to instability and disorder, especially in the areas around the equator. What about the relation between climate and national security? How do you think about that?
Well, I must admit that going back really to the Cold War, the overarching approach to national security was premised on the conviction that we can be safe and prosperous here at home only if we can try to control whatever the hell is going on out there. You know, out there was in Europe, out there was in Korea, out there was in Vietnam. My guess is that partly as a result of climate change, partly as a result of the pandemic, there's a growing awareness that we need to pay attention to security closer to home, that we need to protect Americans where they live from threats that may be different threats than we used to think about. You know, the threat of communism, the threat of Soviet expansionism. But we need to protect Americans from climate change. We need to protect Americans from pandemics. We need to protect them from, you know, forest fires that just ravage the Pacific coast. If you take that seriously, if that would be taken seriously as a basis of policy, then we probably spend less money on the military. And without dismissing the notion that climate change could cause instability out there, we may not attribute as much seriousness to that possibility. I mean, I am not an expert on this, but I mean, what you read is as climate change proceeds, large parts of Bangladesh are going to be inundated, and places where millions of people live will be underwater, and this population will be displaced. Well, first of all, that is an immense human tragedy, and the world should do whatever it can to prevent it. But strictly from a national security point of view, I'm not sure that that matters all that much. At least it matters less than the effects of climate change here at home, because it seems to me we see in the changing weather patterns, the storms, the fires, that authorities need to do much more to ensure that Americans are safe where they live, and to ensure that we can exercise our freedoms. And that becomes more important than worrying about what's going on the other side of the world. And we'll see if the Biden administration agrees with anything what I was just saying.
Yes. Well, see, I see the Washington Post has a story on Wednesday saying that Biden is going to inject climate considerations to every department of government, agriculture, transportation, and the military. So we'll see what that means and if that actually comes through. What do you make of Trump just decapitating the civilian leadership of the Pentagon? And generally, what his relationship with the military was? There's some evidence that he got like 80% of the military vote. What do you make of Trump's relations with the military? And what's he trying to accomplish with the Pentagon in its final days?
I think it's impossible to say. And I know there's speculation that he's making these personnel adjustments because he wants to make a mad dash to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan so he can claim a policy victory. There's some speculation that you know, this is evil stuff. There's some speculation that he thinks he can mobilize the military in some capacity to keep him in office. Could be. My guess is no. I think for all practical purposes, he has ceased to govern. He's lost. He only had a modest interest in governing, even in the middle of his presidency. I think he has ceased to govern, so he's settling some scores. He's that kind of a guy. But it's almost as if there's no one in charge. And, of course, that can be dangerous in and of itself. From a national security perspective, who is paying attention to what adversaries are doing around the world? I don't think the president is, and that's a danger.
Well, he never paid any attention.
Yes, to a very considerable extent, he has been our least informed and laziest commander-in-chief.
Perversely, he did accomplish a fair amount. Changed the discourse around immigration. He changed a lot about immigration policy. You know, he got his tax cuts, deregulated just about everything in sight. So he did manage to, despite his lack of interest in governing, he accomplished something.
Almost all of which is reversible and will be reversed. Now, what's the permanent legacy going to be? I think it will be rather slight. I've always felt that, you know, that his critics seem to assume that his presidency was an exceedingly important one. I think it's likely to be, in retrospect, one of the least important because most of the damage that he has done can be corrected.
It feels like a four-year migraine.
I understand.
I'm speaking with the historian and political analyst Andrew Bacevich. Let's look at some of the security challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. Russia, for example. It's a country that his party has demonized, spent the last 4 years blaming for the advent of Trump. What are the fundamentals of the U.S.-Russia relation at this point?
Well, first of all, not to avoid the question, maybe I am, I think that China...
Was my next question.
but let's begin with China. And we're setting aside climate now. We're setting aside sort of global issues. We're talking about geopolitics. I think that the perceived threat of China will dominate the geopolitical analysis. I think that there actually is pretty close to a consensus among Republicans and Democrats viewing China as a growing threat and almost welcoming. We're not quite there yet. But almost welcoming the prospect of a Cold War with China. So I think in terms of the geopolitical discussion, debate, argument, China's going to come first. And that, I think, is likely to have immense policy implications, budgetary implications, perhaps implications where U.S. forces are stationed or where they're withdrawn so that they can be repositioned. So I think China is going to be a lot more important than Russia. It ought to be more important because Russia is not the Soviet Union. Lots of people say that, but somehow or other, when it comes to analysis, we still think of Russia as the Soviet Union of, you know, decades ago.
Trump's racism about China really masked a really underlying fundamental conflict. That sort of thing is real. It's whether we're talking about competition for Silicon Valley or competition over real estate around the South China Sea. I mean, these are all really actual conflicts, but also of great increasing potential, right?
Yeah, I mean, they are tough problems. I hope you're not looking to me to give you the 2 minute answer to how we're going to deal with China. The essence of the problem is that. We have difficulty. We as a people have difficulty acknowledging that we're not going to be number one forever, as in the premier nation on the planet, the indispensable nation. And I fully expect that China continues its rise and its development, that they're going to, you know, hit all kinds of bumps in the road. But the so-called unipolar order that some people believed had been created by the end of the Cold War is gone for good. We live in a multipolar order. And I think it's difficult, perhaps, for some people inside the political establishment to accept that reality. Analogy is imperfect. But we're a little bit in the situation that Great Britain found itself, even between the two wars, world wars, when it was clear that Britain was in relative decline, that the British economy was lagging behind, certainly lagging behind our economy, and after 1933, lagging behind the German economy. And the British political establishment had been accustomed for generations to being really the global hegemon. And all the signs indicated, even in the 1930s, maybe you could argue in the 1920s, that those days were passing. It was very difficult, I think, for the British establishment to adjust to that reality. It was a little bit easier for them to adjust to that reality because they were going to, if they had to pass the baton of world leadership, they were going to pass the baton to us. One can easily go too far in talking about Anglo-American friendship and all that sort of stuff. But it is the case that by and large, British interests and American interests aligned. So it was easier for them to surrender the baton to us. It's difficult for us to surrender the baton if it's being passed to the People's Republic of China, because we don't have any historical, cultural, religious affinity with this Asian country.
But now, yeah. Hillary Clinton, of course, was big with during her tenure as Secretary of State, the pivot to Asia, the pivot towards China. What, if anything, came of that?
I guess I'd say not a lot. You know, there's certainly been documents produced that move Asia up sort of in the list of national security priorities. There are reform movements within the services, particularly the Army, the Marine Corps, and, of course, the Navy, are trying to redesign those services with an eye toward conflict in the Asia Pacific. You know? I don't mean that they're all sort of gearing up to have a war with China, but that has become the contingency that drives planning and drives decisions on what kind of weapon systems we're going to buy and what kind of systems we're not and where we need to have bases and so on. So I think that part is underway. It reminds me a little bit of what happened after 1980 when Jimmy Carter promulgated the Carter Doctrine, which basically told the Pentagon to pay more attention to the Persian Gulf. And that resulted in a host of actions, war plans being written, exercise programs being modified, negotiations for bases and overflight rights, because the Pentagon had been told, get ready to fight in the Persian Gulf. I'm stating it more bluntly, I think, than anybody would say out loud. They've been told to get ready to fight China. So that results in a host of sort of programmatic adjustments.
The impact of Trump, he's allegedly destroyed multilateralism, you know, in the favor of his unilateralism that he prefers, his volatility, recklessness, lack of clarity about what his intentions were, you know, his penchant for contradicting himself. How much lasting effect will he have on all these security relationships and the U.S. approach to the outside world?
My guess is that the impact is going to be limited and, if not completely reversible, substantially reversible, because our allies in particular will see Biden as a throwback to that earlier period, someone who believes in the tradition of American leadership that evolved in the wake of World War II. So in NATO, for example, remember Trump despised NATO. NATO will breathe a sigh of relief because we can expect, I would be shocked if this did not happen, we can expect Biden to offer NATO assurances that the United States intends to stay, will be a loyal ally. Much the same is going to apply to arms agreements, for example, with Russia, with trade agreements. So it's going to be a back to the future kind of a scenario, which is good and is bad. It's good because Trump was a disaster. You did a nice job there of sort of reviewing his deficiencies. And normalcy means predictable behavior on the part of the United States. They're welcome. But the bad news is, as I suggested early on, I'm not sure that it's useful for us to think that we're still in that post-Cold War era where we assumed that we were the indispensable nation. I think we're in a different period, and we need to do a lot of hard thinking about what our role in the world ought to be. You know, again, we have to see who he appoints to the key jobs. But I don't expect that they're going to be terribly creative.
To some degree, Trump was reflecting, in his very crude way, the decline of U.S. preeminence. And his rhetoric was not adequate to the situation. His understanding was not adequate to the situation. But, you know, he did in some way recognize the fact that the United States was not that indispensable country anymore, or acted that way. It's not going to be easy to step back into that status quo ante. And it's not just Trump. It's like real fundamental structural change in the world.
Right. I think you're exactly right. And it ain't going to be easy. I mean, to me, the most important fact of this election that some people are talking about, but I think that in the euphoria of Biden winning really doesn't get enough attention, is that Trump won over 70 million votes. He increased his vote total. He won more votes. He won more votes than any candidate for the presidency ever, with the exception of Joe Biden. Won more votes than Obama won in 2008. My point is, even if Trump goes away, I mean, even if he would go away quietly, which would be a wonderful thing. We got 70 million of our fellow citizens who wanted him to have four more years. And I think that, I don't know what that means, although I'm pretty darn sure that they're not all going to jump on the Biden bandwagon after January 20th. So there will continue to be, I think, a great deal of contention about what our role in the world ought to be.
That was Andrew Bacevich, a historian and president of the Quincy Institute, which is named after John Quincy Adams, who said in an 1821 speech that the U.S. goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Of course it does, and in search of monsters often of its own invention. And that's the problem. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Tall buildings at the head of all nations, worthy men from Spain and Siam. All their discussions with the Russians, but they still went ahead and beat all the plans. Now up jumps the U.S. representative. He's the one with the tight eyes. 747 for him in that condition, flying back from a peacekeeping mission. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows.
That was some of So It Goes by Nick Lowe from the prehistoric days of 1976. Next, understanding female desire, a topic that may strike regular listeners as somewhat unusual. But it's a welcome relief, not just from election news, but also the intense overdose of raging masculinity 4 years of Trump have subjected us to. Back in 2009, the journalist Daniel Bergner published an article in the New York Times Magazine called What Do Women Want?, echoing Freud's famous question. It generated an unusually large amount of attention for a magazine article and was eventually turned into a book of the same name. Its most notable feature was a report on the work of Meredith Chivers, a University of Toronto researcher. Chivers showed her male and female subjects a variety of videos of sex in various configurations, including among bonobos. The subjects were fitted with plethysmographs, devices that fit over a penis to measure its swelling or inside a vagina to measure its blood flow. These are presumed to be the physical signs of sexual excitement. Subjects were also told to report their subjective level of excitement using a keypad. Curiously, male self-reports largely matched the physical signs, but not so among women. Women often showed the signs of excitement, while reporting they experienced none. Also, women generally showed physical reactions to a variety of visual stimuli, whereas men were moved by a much narrower palette. Much was made of this, as we'll hear. Among other things, the research, and Bergner's report on it, reinforced a lot of notions about fundamental differences between the sexes, and are a reminder how far we've traveled from the sexual binary over the last decade. The sociologist Alison Spurgis, who teaches at Trinity College, is just out with a book, published by Ohio State University Press, called Diagnosing Desire, Biopolitics and Femininity into the 21st Century. In it, she casts a critical eye at this sort of research and what it tells us about how we see women. Alison Spurgis. You open the book with this retelling of a scenario that Daniel Bergner concocted in the New York Times Magazine about 10 years ago about the split between women's bodies and their minds. And that, you know, attracted a lot of attention. A lot of conversation has been very influential ever since. But could you summarize what he found and how that fits into this very dominant model of female sexuality?
The important thing there is that he was reporting on what these scientists were talking about. So with these clinicians and therapists, sex therapists, and experimental sexologists, you know, these researchers, he really identifies like a few of these very key figures, you know, the figures that become key to my analysis. They're just very well known at this point. These women that were, you know, identified as feminists were, you know, very serious about helping women to, you know, enhance their desire. He was basically just outlining this trend that we start to see at the turn of the 21st century. There's definitely a lineage before that, beginning in, you know, probably the 60s and 70s. In the kind of post-Masters and Johnson era, there's this shift toward thinking about women's sexuality specifically as responsive or receptive. And I think that we start to really see that being taken up and applied to this idea about the mind-body split in the plethysmographic research. So, you know, some of the earliest studies using plethysmographs on women that detected this discordance between objective, so-called objective physiological arousal and subjective desire were tracked to these studies in the 70s. So some of the people that were doing them were Julia Hyman, Hoon and Wince. You know, there's a couple seminal studies using the plethysmograph in this way. And basically what was shown through this research is that women, you know, and of course here it's cis women and, you know, often cis white women and ones who self-select to even, you know, have this kind of testing done on them, they have a discordance that basically women are more likely to have this kind of free-flowing, objectively detectable arousal, but often don't say that they feel turned on. And I think this is a real shift because actually Masters and Johnson were trying to be pretty gender neutral. And I think that most of their work following Freud, they wanted to be very just kind of objective and say that both men and women have sex drives and they, you know, they come up with the human sexual response cycle. It's very linear. And in the following decades, there's a lot of critique of that linearity. And basically the idea that starts to get put forward, I think adjacent to the discordance research with the plethysmograph, is the idea that linearity doesn't work for women. And then that's kind of the birth of this responsive or receptive desire that my book is about.
It's funny that, you know, Freud famously asked the question, what does a woman want, for which he's been roundly mocked for decades on end. But people are still asking that same question.
Exactly. Yeah. And another important piece actually to just mention is the research that uses similar technology, the plethysmograph, the photoplethysmograph, what's sometimes called a penile strain gauge for men, it does the exact opposite kind of work when it's used with men. And so it's often used in forensic psychology. It's used to prove that a man is turned on. So basically the idea is that men are aligned and concordant and women are not. And then the plethysmograph for men has been used as forensic evidence, for instance, to say that pedophiles are actually pedophiles because there is this kind of like mind-body synchronicity. But then for women, it's the idea that they actually don't link up.
In this model, men are very simple creatures. They just want, as one of your chapter subheadings says, men want only one thing, which is curiously, my mother said that to me in exactly those words repeatedly throughout my youth. But that, you know, there's that men just want one thing. They're very simple creatures. They get excited. They climax and then they're done. Whereas women, you know, it's much more complicated. And the assumption is that arousal precedes desire rather than desire preceding arousal. What about that sequence of desire and arousal and the way these researchers paint this picture?
Yeah, well, I think that so following this research with the photoplethysmographs that studied women's discordance, there then becomes this immersion around the turn of the 21st century into this arousal-first model, this trigger-based model. And so we see people like, Rosemary Basson, who's a researcher in Canada, in Vancouver, she comes up with this model that is evidence-based. She says that she's, this is what women are telling her in a clinical space, that they often feel neutral in any given sexual encounter. They're not turned on, and that it takes them a while to kind of like get worked up. But that basically once they, can get there, then, then they're good to go. Then they're okay.
Yeah, that kind of fits in with a very crude masculinist idea. Hey, honey, you want it.
Yeah, and that's my concern. And I think that's why I wrote this book. Because I was seeing all of this research. I was seeing the ways that these ideas were coming together. And, really in the Bergner articles in 2009 is where I think they really pulls together the model of responsive desire. He talks about female flexibility and fluidity. He just kind of showcases what's been going on for the last decade or more. I don't think that for these researchers, these feminist identified psychologists, I don't think there's any ill intent. I don't think that they are trying to have a model that quite frankly sounds rapey. I think that there is this idea that women just need a little bit more time. They need to have the trigger. They need to have the arousal first. But what my intervention is meant to do is to say a lot of this is because of the stories that we tell ourselves about men and women. Right. And that's exactly what you're saying about what you were told. Right. So we're just told this. And so I have no doubt that women come into clinical spaces and say, well, I just need a while to get turned on. And what I question and what I have concerns about is why they get that idea in the first place and what kind of sex they're even having. I just think it's doing a disservice to women to just assume this kind of receptivity or responsiveness.
It's interesting because some of these models reflect very crude popular notions of the difference between men and women and put it in very scientific language. And then once it acquires the prestige of science, it gets reabsorbed and reinforces the inherited common sense.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's kind of what I think has been happening. In this effort to move away from the so-called linearity of the human sexual response cycle that Masters and Johnson laid out in the 60s, really beginning in the 50s. They lay out this response cycle and they say basically you get turned on and then there's plateau and then there's an orgasm and it's this linear model. And then Helen Singer Kaplan comes along and adds desire as kind of like that first step. But she's definitely continuing the Masters and Johnson's lineage. And, there starts to be some feminist critique, I think, in the 80s and 90s, particularly, of the linearity of that model. Just the idea that it's very goal-driven, it's very goal-oriented, it's too linear. But the idea is that it's too linear for women, right? There's never attention to men and how maybe it actually doesn't really work for men either. Maybe not all men have this perfect sequence where they just get turned on and then they are stimulated and have a plateau and then have an orgasm.
Yeah, well, this has affinities with a certain kind of cultural feminism.
Yes.
Treated women as fundamentally different and better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know if the better part of it always comes through in this research, but in chapter 3 of my book, I make the argument that this is connected to ideas from cultural feminism, that even though, with the work of someone like Leonore Tiefer and the New View campaign beginning in in the 90s, there's this idea that we need to move away from the linearity. But I think that there's an essentialism. People like that wanted to talk about the social construction of sexuality, but I think that there's an essentialism underneath. And I think that can be tracked back to cultural feminism and even some of the sex therapy that came out of cultural feminism. Women need to masturbate more and learn how to do that, but you should use your hand. If you use a vibrator, it's unnatural. we actually hear that kind of thing come out of this cultural feminist tendency.
We should have a moment of silence for Betty Dodson, who died a few days ago, right?
Yes, no, that's true. And Betty Dodson, I think, does things a bit differently and is not part of that lineage in quite the same way.
Around all this, the lack of female desire is portrayed as a pathology. Is it a pathology? Does it exist? What did the women you interviewed have to say about that?
I actually think that this model of responsive and receptive desire was introduced to depathologize women's kind of lack of free-flowing desire. Like, I think that's what they intended. But my argument in the book is that this was short-sighted, was that kind of that critiquing this goal-oriented human sexual response cycle model and replacing it with receptivity and responsiveness, but doing so only for women, you know, and the fact that that culminates in this new diagnosis in the DSM-5, the FSIA diagnosis, female sexual interest/arousal disorder, that's for women only. And I think that there's a way that it was an attempt to depathologize women's low desire, to basically say, you don't have low desire, you're not pathological just because you don't get turned on immediately. You know, maybe you just need some time to build it up. But the problem that I see in that is, again, it just kind of rehearses these ideas about flexibility and fluidity. And so to get to the women that I interviewed, I basically put up these flyers and I just said, I didn't say they have to have a diagnosis. My book is not a medical ethnography. It's a convenience sample, but I actually think that it's important that it is, because it means that so many different kinds of women who have felt pathological came and wanted to talk to me. All these women contacted me, you know, of different walks of life, and basically said, I do feel like I have low desire. And we talked for, you know, hours about this. And what I found is that for a lot of them, I don't think they actually have low desire. And I think they even by the end of the interviews would kind of say, maybe I don't have low desire, or maybe that was a problem before, or maybe that was very specific to this relationship that I was in, right, that I was unhappy in or something. But what I found was that the receptivity and responsiveness model also doesn't really work for all of those women. And what I try to outline toward the end of the book is why I think that it's a problem to kind of institute that responsiveness receptivity model. Because what I think it does is it makes women kind of expect themselves to be receptive and responsive too often to men. I think it also rehearses ideas about what sexuality scholars have called compulsory sexuality, you know, and compulsory heterosexuality. In an effort to depathologize and move away from one problematic model, we then institute a new problematic model, you know, and then I think women actually feel pathological if they're not receptive and responsive.
Yeah, I mean, some of the women you talked with had plenty of desire, but just not in conventional channels.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, they wanted polyamory, they wanted BDSM, they were sick of their partner, they realized they were queer, you know, they had all kinds of, you know, they had lots of spontaneous desire, they had all kinds of fantasies. I think that that's not captured by this model. I think that the model continues to produce this idea over and over again that women aren't that sexual, right? That women are just like not particularly sexual creatures. And that's just kind of how, and that there's nothing wrong with that per se, but that's just not how women are. And I think that does a disservice. I think that does a disservice to women.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Allison Spergus, author of Diagnosing Desire from Ohio State University Press. Yeah, I mean, there's you write about ways in which sex can then get reconfigured in heterosexual relationships in particular as a kind of care work. Women provide sex just like they, you know, might cook or clean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the socially reproductive work, you know, and so this, you know, this tracks back to the people like the wages for housework, autonomous Marxist feminists, you know, the Italian kind of lineage, you know, like Federici and Maria Rosa Della Costa and Selma James, who were thinking about the ways that particular forms of care under the sign of social reproduction become, they're not only gendered, but they're raced. You know, there's just a whole way that becomes understood to be the world of women. Even more perniciously, sometimes the world of women of color, to kind of just like do this work. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a danger in the way that the FSIA diagnosis is framed, the fact that women wouldn't get the diagnosis just because they're not spontaneously desiring, but because they're also not receptive. Like that would be part of the framework. That just is one more way that this idea that women should be receptive, you know, and not only to men, but actually kind of, I mean, this is where I bring in the biopolitical argument in the chapter on sexual care work. You know, this idea that it's not even just like servicing a partner, you know, and which for the record can end up extending into queer relationships too. It's not even, I think that women just learn that at such an early age, it can be like affective kind of labor. It can be, you know, I have the subtitle Giving Daddy 5 Kisses a Day.
That was weird and creepy.
Yeah. I mean, it's not always just purely sexual. Like it's all of this kind of feminized work that even like little girls are expected to do. And then I think, so it runs the gamut, you know, from that kind of thing to then explicit providing sex for a partner. You know, my interviewee Astrid is kind of the most upsetting example, because this is a person who actually did go through a program to try to alleviate low desire, and in her case also vulvodynia. And, you know, she was in an abusive relationship, and it was just never picked up on by the clinicians, you know, when she was going through this treatment program. But this was a very young person who was in a relationship that was abusive with an older man, you know, and so it wasn't, her problem was not like that she had low desire. Her problem was not even that she had vulvodynia. Her problem was that she didn't identify as a woman, you know, ultimately, and she didn't want to be in this abusive relationship. You know, and she felt like this entire realm of queer sex in which she might identify as stone butch or just not use her body in the same way that would be expected to be used. She goes through this whole program, and it's never caught basically by these people that's her experience. And so I think that even though that's just one example, and even though it's a kind of extreme example, I think it's an example very much worth paying attention to, because it shows us like what can happen when we do train women, you know, what it means to be responsive and receptive in terms of feminine. And then the other thing that emerged in that chapter is that I also think there's a way that women are not only expected to service partners, but there's a way that like women are expected to be sexual and feel pleasure for like humanity, like for like the earth. Like there's this kind of very strange cultural feminist, yet also biopolitical argument that I think is also rooted in this compulsory sexuality narrative.
What's like that old lie back and think of England?
Yeah. I mean, it's that, but it's like an extension of that, because it's like you should be doing this not only for your partner, but like for your family. It's almost like for the good of like heterosexuality. It's this very strange women's pleasure will save everything. Like women should, but then it becomes a mandate, right? It becomes this way that like then it's like, well, if you're not enjoying sex and you're not like, and you don't want that, then like there's a problem and you're letting everybody down. You know, you're letting like your family down. You're letting your partner down. That's a really dangerous narrative that women should feel pleasure and should be expected to feel pleasure. That kind of goes along with this idea that women should smile, right? Women are walking down the street and get catcalled, you know, when women are told you'd be prettier if you smiled. I think that's another example of that. It's this kind of like feminine, like, hospitality or like conviviality. Like there's a way that like women are expected to do that, to have a smile and make everybody feel better.
Yeah, I'm very glad nobody's ever told me to smile.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about this with my sociology of gender students all the time, you know, and it's every single woman in the class, every single person who identifies as a woman or has been treated as a woman their whole life has stories of being told to smile, of being, you know, feeling like you can't go for a walk or a run without being ogled or catcalled, you know, and there are never cis men in my classes, you know, that have that experience.
The pharmaceutical interventions in this area are revealing in their contrast. Viagra and the like treat male sexual dysfunction as a plumbing issue, where the drugs have been invented, and their names haven't even entered the popular vocabulary the way Viagra has. They're all about the psychological angle and fixing desire. So, like, men, just, you know, you need to fix the plumbing, but women, there's, like, all that complexity that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so I think when we look at the story of flibanserin, you know, brand named Addy, that's exactly that, right? Like there were all these different things that were tried, you know, after the success of Viagra for women. Like, it was like, should we give women testosterone? Should we give women Viagra itself? You know, like, what is the quick fix? And women kept on kind of eluding this, you know, this ability to be fixed in this way. Again, I think because of expectations, I think of gendered, you know, expectations. Like I haven't read any qualitative research, for instance, with like women who were on testosterone or took the various, you know, bromelanotide or Vyleesi or any of these things that came out, like what their actual experiences were on those drugs. But I think it's definitely worth noting that kind of what the industry ends up arriving at is basically an antidepressant. You know, it's a neurotransmitter drug. It's absolutely nothing like Viagra whatsoever.
But a lot of antidepressants are notorious for depressing libido.
Yeah, I know. And that's the other bizarre irony, right? Like, how does that even work? But another thing that I do focus on in the book that I think is an important piece of the story is that during this whole last, 20 years, there's been, while this kind of race to find the female Viagra was going on, mindfulness, women using mindfulness to kind of tap into their natural free-flowing desire to what I call bridge the gap.
Yeah, I mean, in appropriating mindfulness to increase productivity of the job, but also, I guess, productivity on the sexual job.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my fear, And I think that there's a way that, all the mindfulness discourse kind of got framed as, oh, well, that's fine because it's, safe and it's not a drug. And yes, it's not a drug, and in that way, that's good. But I don't know. I think it is a form of training. I think it's, and this is again the kind of biopolitical angle I have here, rooted in a Foucauldian kind of analysis. It's a training. It's a form of, not even a discipline. Well, in some cases, maybe a disciplinary training. Be mindful so that you can service your partner in your relationship. But it's also, again, part of that weird feminine hospitality argument. You should be feeling pleasure. Why are you not feeling pleasure? Feel more pleasure. Don't you want to feel pleasure? You know you want to feel pleasure. And it becomes...
It's your duty.
Exactly. It becomes a feminine duty to tap into your own natural free-flowing desire. Again, going back to that discordance narrative, the idea that women have this always already there physiological arousal, but that they just don't know it. They have a hard time tapping into it. So then mindfulness becomes the way to tap into it, And so for me, it's okay, it's either mindfulness or you're taking a brain drug, And in both cases, what's being worked on is the desire itself, is the idea that you just need to kind of, you need to know that you're not going to feel desire like a man does, because you're going to be receptive and responsive. Because you're a woman, that's the argument, And then B, you should work on that. You should tap into this kind of free-flowing arousal. Again, for the good of your relationship, for the good of your family, for the good of heterosexuality. there's a lot of, for the good of the men on the street that catcalled you, and whatever it is. Just so many different ways that this ends up getting framed in that line of thinking.
Finally, you conclude the book, I believe these are the last words of it, extolling a freedom in falling apart together. Could you expand on that? What did you mean by that?
What that comes out of for me is that, ultimately, when I talk to these women that I interview, I didn't specify anything about assault or trauma or any kind of history like that. But what I ended up finding is that all of the women that came to talk to me, again, just unspecified, this is just how the sample ended up, is that they were all either heterosexual or had been in heterosexual relationships and identified as straight at some point, even if they now identify as queer. And almost all of them had experienced some form of sexual assault, something they characterized themselves as traumatic. Some were childhood sexual abuse survivors. Some were, had just been, regularly. There was a whole gamut. Of ways that women had been mistreated and felt like it was a sexualized kind of mistreatment. And so, there is this theme of trauma then that's running through this theme of violation. And again, I think that's part of what the clinicians that came up with these frameworks just don't really pay enough attention to, is the missing discourse really of trauma. The fact that, that women are more likely to be sexually assaulted than men. And that a lot of women with low desire have been, assaulted. So I think that what I'm getting at with that last chapter and the theorization of the falling apartness, this idea of falling apart together, is that that would be a really radical and different way of dealing with trauma, that it would be a more collective, that it would be a true kind of revolutionary and woman-focused kind of healing vision. And I know it gets a little bit kind of lofty. It's not as easy to nail down. But I think that it also emerges because so much of the discourse in the psychology that I critique, and my book is a critique. I mean, it's a very deep, scathing critique. That's ultimately what it ends up being, is so much of what's happening in psychology is individualized. you know, it's so like, just be mindful. Here's the way you do it. You know, like you can learn how to do it on your own and then you can do it. You can be more, again, like productive, sexually productive. Most of the treatments that we see, whether it's drugs, whether it's mindfulness, are really part of this neoliberal world, right? This very kind of individualized neoliberal marketplace where we're all expected to heal on our own, to do it quickly, you know, that treatments should be brief, that it's, you know, and I think there are many good things about cognitive behavioral therapy, for instance, which I think is adjacent to mindfulness here, but I don't think it can solve everything, right? And I think that, you know, as you noted, also throughout the book, I take seriously psychoanalytic explanations. And I think that if we are going to talk about trauma and focus on women's trauma, then we have to be able to engage with psychoanalysis, or at least psychodynamic ways of thinking about this. Mindfulness and the emphasis on cognitive behavioral therapies skirt that, you know, and once again, just focus on the individual. And so at the end, I say, you know, as an antidote to this neoliberal workplace, basically, in which people are meant to become sexually productive, whether it's through mindfulness or drugs or whatever, what if we just fell apart? What if we didn't keep it together, you know, sexually or otherwise?
The boss wouldn't like that, though.
No, the boss would not like that. No, exactly. But so, no, it is. I see it as a feminist, collectivist, I mean, it's a communist call, right? It's a very, I think that's the kind of underlying idea, is that what if people who have been treated in this way and do have problems with their desire because of it, you know, and maybe in some cases really miss having better sex or stronger desire, what if we came together to kind of have this experience and just kind of let it fall apart? And wouldn't that be so much different than just trying to hold it all together under neoliberal capitalism and just get by? So I see it as an alternative to that discourse of just trying to get by. And I see it really as a different form of survival.
That was Allison Spurgis, author of Diagnosing Desire, just out from Ohio State University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song that suggests that women are not the only ones with issues of low sexual desire. Libido by Naked Raygun. Till next week, bye.